Give a listen. The sound of sizzling bacon and the delicious smell that goes along with it is a good indication of how far along the cooking is and whether it's time to turn it or serve it up.
Our next guest says we should pay more attention to all of our senses when we're cooking. Julia Moskin is a food writer for the New York Times, and you can find her list of 10 ways to develop your food senses on the Central Time Facebook page. Julia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a lot of us, when we're cooking, we think about how food tastes. We take a little tasting spoon. We take a look at it. Does it look brown? But you're saying that there's a whole range of the other senses that we're ignoring that can really up our cooking game. Why are those other senses so important?
Well, I think a lot of people know, or perhaps are learning, that a big component of taste is actually smell. And that doesn't only apply to the fact that, you know, if you're blindfolded and you bite into a potato or an apple, it's very hard to tell the difference. If you're an experienced cook, you can actually smell when a steak is done. You can smell when your scrambled eggs are ready. You can smell all sorts of things that a more inexperienced cook doesn't think about. And that was sort of the idea for this article. One of the main senses that I noticed that cooks who are, for example, visually impaired use is hearing.
Let's talk about how we develop this, because talking about smell, I feel like I do this now. I know when olive oil smells like it's just heated up enough, but it took me a long time to get there. How do we intentionally acquire these skills apart from just cooking a lot over the years?
Well, certainly cooking is really the best way to learn to cook. There isn't really a magic shortcut. But you can kind of try to pay attention to some of these things. And one thing that I was working with a chef who was blind on this story, and I had her come to my kitchen, and we talked about, I had her blindfold me, and she had me listening to the different sounds of a simmer, a boil, and a fast boil, for example, for water, or the sound of what it's what a steak should sound like when it's in a frying pan. It really should be a steady, even sound. If you're hearing popping, if you're hearing these sort of rhythmic changes, that means that you're probably cooking it at too high a heat. So it's not only cooking, but cooking and just trying to pay a little bit of attention can really pay off.
And you were talking about listening and how you were learning. One of the things you write about is learning to listen to a cake. So apparently a cake makes a different sound when it's not quite done. And when it's done baking, how can you hear that?
Well, you know, this is a long time thing that this wonderful Southern cook, Edna Lewis, who grew up in Virginia and in a community that was started by freed slaves. And she lived well into, I'm not sure, the 21st century, but she really brought a lot of kitchen wisdom. And one of them was listening to a sponge cake. And if you think about it, it really makes sense. What her point was is that it stops, she used to say it stops ticking when it's done. But what that means is, you know, when a cake is cooking, when it's rising, the steam inside the little cells of, for example, a sponge cake is expanding and popping. And so when that is no longer happening, sort of when you're like at sleepaway camp and you can hear how the popcorn isn't popping anymore, that's when it's done.
So do you have to hold the cake up right next to your ear, or is this audible enough that
you
can?
Do not put your head in the oven. Take the cake out and just hold it up to your ear. You do have to listen rather closely. And I learned that from a woman who teaches something called pie workshops, and she has Pie Camp, Kate McDermott. And she is a very quirky pie baker out in the state of Washington. And she says, and this was actually my primary inspiration for the article, she talks about the heartbeat of a pie.
And you use the phrase in the piece, the sizzle wump of a pie.
Yes.
Which I love.
I know.
That
really
was worth the price of admission all by itself.
The heartbeat is much more lyrical, but the sizzle wump tells you what you're listening for.
It's what's happening there.
The sizzle is of the fat in a pie crust. Obviously, that would be lard or Crisco or butter, whatever it is that you use. But what's really happening is that you're cooking the flour in the pie crust when you're baking it. And so just like any other kind of cooking in fat, you're going to hear a little bit of sizzle. That means that the crust is actually cooking along nicely, and the wump is the bubbling of the filling. When a filling is thickened, because it has to be at a certain temperature with things like tapioca or flour, it's only when they reach a certain temperature that they're thickened. And that thick liquid bumping up against the top crust makes kind of a whomp, whomp, whomp sound. Wow. So you're hearing the sizzle and the whomp, and that's the heartbeat of the pie.
Well, we know that, for instance, when a person loses their eyesight, some other senses become more acute, maybe sense of touch, to compensate and to get that same information in different ways. For cooking, for our purposes, using the senses to be a better cook, does it take a long time to develop these skills?
Well, certainly if you have no choice. For example, the blind cook that I worked with, whose name is Christine Ha, and she actually won a season of the show MasterChef. She had sight, and then she lost her sight during her 20s. And a neurologist I worked with on the story explained to me that what happens over a long period of time is that the neurons that are attached to your eyes actually can be refocused to your fingertips. So the piece of your brain that takes in information from your eyes will actually be redirected, and your fingertips will become much more sensitive. And it's definitely something that is hard for those of us who don't use touch exclusively to understand. But it is something like a really good example of that is to use coarse salt. And, you know, that's something that a lot of times a recipe will call for a quarter of a teaspoon of salt, half a teaspoon of salt. And you have to go get your measuring spoons, you have to go, you know, pour it in carefully, and you usually end up spilling a lot on the counter. And what Christine does is that she has memorized the feeling in her fingers of a quarter of a teaspoon of salt. And that's actually really easy to do. I did it, you know, in 10 minutes, just doing it over and over again. And, you know, it really is the kind of thing that saves time and that the kind of thing that makes people enjoy cooking. Because let's face it, when cooking takes forever, when you have to measure everything, when you don't have the knife skills to cut an onion, it's not fun. But there are so many ways that you can educate not only your palate, but also your ears, your nose, your fingertips to become a quicker cook.
Talking to Julia Moskin, New York Times food reporter, talking about how we can use the power of all of our senses in our cooking to make our cooking better. And Julia, you write, and this seems to be one overarching message here, sometimes relying on the simmer for 2 minutes or low heat or whatever, the really precise instructions that might be in a recipe, isn't going to do us as much good as paying attention with all our senses.
You're right, Rob. It's really an amazing thing when you start thinking about it, because recipes, of course, now we have video recipes. We have a lot of different additional ways of learning how to cook or being taught. But essentially, recipes are, you know, one-dimensional words on a page that are trying to describe a very complicated, multidimensional, real-world, five-senses experience. And it's really not possible. As someone who writes recipes for a living, it is really difficult to write. If you wrote absolutely every step, every recipe would be thousands of words long. So you really do have the ability to learn a lot of these sensory cues so that you won't have to follow, you know, what it says. I mean, when you're browning onions, now some people feel, in some recipes it says, oh, that takes 8 to 10 minutes. In some recipes it says 25 to 30 minutes. And that really depends on how fast you're cooking it, how often you're stirring it. And you can tell by learning, you know, what your way of cooking onions is and the sensory cues, like you know it's done when it smells a certain way, when it looks a certain way. And then you don't have to rely on recipes. And frankly, most of your dishes will turn out better.
If you think about cooking shows that are on today, there's often stuff going on in the background. They're kind of noisy and bustly. Does this mean that we should be thinking about cooking as more of a sort of sensory deprivation tank? Well, maybe not the right word there, but where there's not music in the background, there's not a TV blaring, you're not focusing on 10 different things, but you're very honed in on just the sounds of things and the feel of things, less distractions.
Definitely. It also can really be pleasant. There is a series of videos on YouTube. It's called, if you look up Silent Cooking, of people listening to just the sounds of cooking, of someone chopping onions in a very orderly way, someone grating chocolate. I mean, there is a sort of soothing, meditative quality about preparing food that a lot of people find. Now, obviously, if you get home at 6 on a Tuesday and you have to get dinner on the table at 6:30, you're not going to be in a meditative mood. But I do find that on Sundays, for example, or anytime when you have a little extra time, you know, if you kind of have I hesitate to use the word mindful because it's kind of overused these days, but that is related to sensory cooking, and you're just paying attention to the sounds of things, the feeling of things, and I really find that you can, you know, have a pretty relaxing time and feel better afterwards, and you have a good dinner for your family.
Yeah, you write about actually a brain state that people can go into. It's something like when somebody is brushing your hair or something like that. If you really get into this in this right mode, you're actually entering this different state of, I don't know, consciousness is quite it, but a happier mental zone.
Yeah, it's something called ASMR, and it is some people even like to listen to other people eating. That's the other food aspect of it. And in addition to cooking, and they think about, oh my God, that cheeseburger looks so delicious. And maybe it's because they're on a diet and they're not eating cheeseburgers. But yeah, there is kind of this trance-like state that some people do get from these sounds of cooking. I think that is, you know, a pretty specialized version of this.
And Julia, we've talked about several of them, but could you leave us with a couple exercises to try in the kitchen to get better at this?
Well, certainly the listening is really important and the picking up the salt. One of my favorite things that I did, which was on the advice of Christine, was to just choose one shelf of the refrigerator and one shelf in your pantry for the ingredients you use most often. Because what I noticed when I was working with her is that I waste so much time when I'm cooking looking for things, you know, things that I know, you know, and I can even see them. She does it by touch. But, you know, where's the olive oil? Where's the soy sauce? Where are the lemons? You know, usually those things are really, if they're just in the same place, you can reach for them much more automatically and you save a lot of time. And I found that to be just a revelation of how much time I waste by using my eyes, partly looking at recipes and also looking for ingredients.
And then how about one using our touch? You talk in the piece about figuring out if fish is done by touching it.
That's a pretty common way for chefs to gauge doneness. You don't like to think about them having their thumbs all over your food in the kitchen, but frankly, that's really the best way. And if you go read the article, there are ways in which you can have press on your different parts of your hand, and it feels like a different state of doneness for like a steak or a fish fillet. And also with fish, this is a really useful thing. If you have a small sharp knife, just slide it into the flesh and then press it to your lips. And fish, particularly, doesn't get very hot. So when it just feels really nice and hot, like a hot shower, that usually means that your fish is done.
Julia, thanks so much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Julia Moskin. She's a food writer for The New York Times, and she joined us to talk about relying more on our senses when we cook. You can find her list of 10 ways to develop your food senses on the Central Time Facebook page.